National Executive Venue, Jim. I'm at the Mel Small Way, that's
No.
I'd like to welcome everybody to this NUJ Fringe meeting that's been organised to mark what the 50th anniversary of Rudolf Rocker's death. Donaha, who's on the National Executive of the NUJ, National Union of Journalists, for those of you who aren't in it, is going to read some extracts from some of Rudolf Rocker's works, from a book, Anarcho-Syndicalism, and another book, The London Years. Then I'm going to speak a bit about trade unions and how, you know, anarcho-syndicalist ideas or the ideas of people like Rocker can be applied in organising in workplaces. And Chekhov Feeney from the Workers' Solidarity Movement is going to finish up by talking about anarchism in the media. I'm Jason Branigan. I'm a member of Organise in Belfast. So I suppose I will just hand over to Donaha here.
One of the interesting things about Rocker is that he had a massive influence on the trade union movement in the UK and the international trade union movement. But the amount of people today who said they have no idea who he was actually surprised me, particularly active trade unionists and active left-wing trade unionists who just seem to have no knowledge of their own history. I think part of the problem, obviously, is that Rocker was an anarchist. And of course the other question I got quite a lot was organised anarchists, how does that happen? Obviously I haven't had a huge turnout from the union. We obviously can't compete with a climate change meeting organised by the SWP, but I think we really need to, you know, what I want to do really interest a paragraph from this book and a little bit from the other is it kind of remind people of what influence Rocker did have and what the effect was in the period before the First World War. So this is a chapter from The London Years by Rocker. It's called The Campaign Against the Sweating System. And it gives you an idea as well of what the situation was like before, particularly the Jewish fabric workers in the East End of London, what the situation they were facing before they got organised and before they were able to change the system. The Jewish working class movement in London had demonstrated its strength. There was a new active spirit among the Jewish workers. We played our part, of course, in the awakening. There were enough grounds for arousing their discontent. We decided to start a big campaign against the evil sweating system from which the Jewish workers suffered most. The British government had for years been concerned with this problem. It had set up a select commission to inquire into it and to recommend ways of dealing with it, but nothing was done. It was all on paper. Even the factory inspectors, who were appointed to see that women and young people should not work all the hours of the day and night, did not stop it. They could not be altogether blamed for it. As long as the workers were not properly organised to prevent it themselves, there were countless ways in which they could be circumvented. For the most important of the sweated industries was tailoring, which was mainly in the hands of foreigners, whose ways were beyond the understanding of English officials. The whole system of factory laws and regulations at the time was so complicated that they could always be gotten around. Also, the skilled workers, who with the subdivisional system had unskilled or less skilled workers under them, were as much interested to cheat the regulations as the master tailors for whom they worked. The clothing industry in the East End was run by hundreds of small master tailors who were subcontractors to the big firms in the city and the West End. In order to get the contract, they underbid each other mercilessly, thus creating their own hell. They passed that hell on, of course, to their workers, the new immigrants, the greeners as they were called, who had just arrived from Poland or Russia or Romania and had to earn their bread, went to these small sweatshops to learn to be pressers or machinists. They started as underpressers or plain machinists, working for about 6 months for a skilled presser or machinist, doing the first preparatory work for them, till they learned to work for themselves. This lower grade of workers was employed and paid not by the master tailor, but by the presser or the machinist. Sometimes a presser or machinist employed 3 or 4 underpressers or plain machinists. It suited the master tailor because it placed the responsibility for driving the workers on the upper grade of the workers themselves. The evil of the sweating system was that it was so contrived that each drove everybody else. The big firms in the city and West End drove the subcontracting master tailors to compete ruthlessly against each other. The master tailor drove his workers and they in turn drove their subordinate workers. It was a vicious circle, each trying to squeeze as much as possible out of those under them. It is understandable that trade union organisation was difficult under such conditions. The subordinate workers had other interests than the skilled workers who employed them. They formed their own unions, but these could not be lasting because their members in time learned their trade and became skilled workers. Then they employed others themselves. As long as the system existed, the effort to organise the workers in proper trade unions was labour of Sisyphus. To add to this trouble, there were a great many young women in the industry who had no interest in trade union organisation because they went to work only until they got married. The first step had to be to persuade the higher grade skilled workers to stop employing subordinate labour, to leave that for the master tailors to do, but most of them didn't want it. They refused to think of the improved labour conditions that organisation could secure for them for the future. They thought only of the money they could lose now. It is hardly possible to conceive today the conditions in which the mass of the Jewish workers in London lived at the time. They were mostly engaged in the clothing industry under what was then the system of subdivisional labour. Each part of the work was done by a different worker who did nothing else, only that one part of the work all the time. The workshops were ordinary living rooms, completely unfitted for the purpose, heavy with the sweat of many working people, to which was added the damp of the pressing irons on the floor. There were no regular hours of work. Employment was completely seasonal. In the busy season, the people worked all the hours of the day and night to save something for the slack season when they earned next to nothing. It was slave driving. In the busy season, the pace was killing. In the slack season, it was hunger and hopeless despair. When we took up the fight against this terrible system, we were told that we were out of touch with the realities of life, that we thought people could feed their families with promises of a better distant future. There is no truth in the charge. We were all aware of the present needs of the workers, and we were concerned to help them now. The files of the Arbeiter Front over the years show that we were telling the Jewish workers all the time that they must stand for an immediate betterment of their lot. There was no trade union meeting, no strike, no smallest effort that the workers made to fight for their daily bread, in which we did not take a part. The fact is that all the Jewish trade unions in the East End, without exception, were started the initiative of Jewish anarchists. The Jewish labour movement grew largely out of the ceaseless education work that we carried on year in, year out. Even those who disagreed with our views cannot deny that what we did in the field of Jewish trade union organisation and activity. It is completely wrong to say that anarchists reject the idea of improvement of conditions in present-day society. What we said was that the people must work and fight for that improvement. It would not come by itself. All social and political progress, from Magna Carta to the 8-hour day, was a result of popular demands to which the authorities had to agree. We told the people that they must always stand on guard to defend their rights and liberties. So when the Jewish labour movement in England had demonstrated its strength, we considered that the time had come for a big practical effort to improve the conditions of the Jewish workers. We called them to join in a united effort against the sweating system. We were, of course, thinking primarily of lifting the evil yoke of the sweatshop system from the Jewish workers. But we also had a second object, which seemed no less important to us, to establish better relations between the Jewish workers and the English workers and the English trade unions. They were far from good then. They couldn't be. The English workers could not feel happy about the development of new industries in the East End of London, which were not subject to trade union discipline and control, especially when those industries kept growing through the immigration of more foreign workers. The English workers didn't know the circumstances which brought those Jewish immigrants to England and made them work under those evil conditions. The result was that they were prejudiced against the Jews, and this might have led to a very ugly situation. Some of the English trade unions had tried to get the Jewish workers to join them, but there was a lack of understanding of the peculiar conditions and nothing came of these efforts. There is no doubt about the anti-Jewish prejudice which existed not only among the English workers, but also among the English trade union leaders. We had an example of it in connection with our protest to demonstrate against the Kitchenette pogrom. We had asked James MacDonald, the chairman of the London Trades Council, to be one of our speakers, and he refused. He said that the Jewish workers in London had acted as strike breakers, doing work that strikers in Edinburgh had refused to do. He even published his accusations in Reynolds' newspaper. We could not find out if it was true. There were so many hundreds of small workshops in the East End of London that no real control was possible. Of course, MacDonald was wrong to confuse the two issues. We had asked him to protest against the inhuman pogrom policy of the Russian Tsarist government, and the innocent victims of Kishinev were not to blame for what a few Jewish workers had done in London. Besides, we who had organised the demonstration were as much against strike-breaking as MacDonald. MacDonald apologised after the Jewish trades unions protested sharply, but his charge may not have been unfounded. It shows the kind of feeling that existed. I kept calling in the Arbeiter Franks, in article after article, for the Jewish workers to take the initiative to improve their relations with the English workers. We denounced the sweating system, and we carried on an agitation among the Jewish workers for a general strike for its abolition. We raised tremendous support, and we won a great deal of support. Early in 1904, we had enough support to increase the size of the Arbeiter Franks to 12 pages, with 4 pages of literary supplement. On April 6, 1904, we held a public meeting in the Wonderland in Whitechapel to deal with the question of a general strike. There were 5,000 seats, and every one of them was occupied. And there were crowds outside who couldn't get in. The police had the doors closed. Besides our East End Jewish speakers, we had all the leading speakers in our movement in London. Malatesta, Tarita de Marmol. I'll stick with the rest of these. Kropotkin was not well enough to come, but he sent a long message, which was read out to tremendous applause. There was a small strike at the time called by the Jewish Bakers Union. It should be mentioned here, both because it was the prelude to a series of such strikes, and because it showed how even a small thing can become an event if it has a public opinion behind it. The strike was started to get better working conditions for the bakers. Feeling in the East End was so strongly on the side of the workers that the employers' organisation could hardly have stood out against them if the workers had not introduced a new demand. They wanted a trade union label on the bread so that the public could see if it came from a bakery that observed trade union conditions. The whole East End seemed to be solidly behind the workers. A few days after the strike started, some of the small bakers agreed to use the trade union label on their bread. The Jewish women of the East End refused to buy any other. In the East End, bread was sold not only in baker shops, but in all the groceries. The women would buy the provisions first and then ask for a loaf. If it had no trade union label, they would hand it back. The result was that the grocer was left with so much bread in his hands that he took no bread the next day from the non-union baker. The strike was won in a few weeks. The label helped the Jewish Bakers Union to get better conditions in their part of the trade. They were for a long time in advance of the conditions of the workers organised in the English Bakers Unions. It added to the sense of their strength among the Jewish workers generally, and it helped pave the way for the big general strike later against the sweating system. And a few years later, the strike was carried out and was successful, and sweatshops were closed down in London and across England. I'm going to read a very short bit now, because I think you listen to me speak enough, but a very short bit from Anarcho-Syndicalism, which is probably Rocker's most famous work. It's where he was asked to define the ideas of anarcho-syndicalism and write them down so they'd be kept after the collapse of the system in the Spanish Civil War. The landsman of the labour movement is therefore not the political party but the trade union, toughened by daily combat and permeated by the socialist spirit. Only in the realm of economy are the workers able to display their full social strength, for it is the activity of producers which holds together the whole social structure and guarantees the existence of society at all. In any other field they are fighting on alien soil and wasting their strength in hopeless struggles which do not bring them an iota nearer to the goal of their desires. In the field of parliamentary politics, the worker is like the giant Antaeus of Greek legend, whom Hercules was able to strangle in the air after he had lifted his feet off the earth, who was his mother. Only as producer and creator of social wealth does he become aware of his strength. In solidaric union with his fellows, he creates in the trade union the invincible phalanx which can withstand any assault. if it is aflame with the spirit of freedom and animated with the ideal of social justice. For the anarcho-syndicalist, the trade union is by no means a mere transitory phenomenon bound up with the duration of capitalist society. It is the germ of the socialist economy of the future, the elementary organ of socialism in general. Every new social structure makes organs for itself in the body of the old organism. Without this preliminary, any social evolution is unthinkable. Even revolutions can only develop and mature the germs which already exist and have made their way into the consciousness of men. They cannot themselves create these germs or generate new worlds out of nothing. It therefore concerns us to plant these germs while there is yet time and bring them to the strongest possible development, so as to make the task of this coming social revolution easier and to ensure its permanence. And I think basically English history of recent years has shown that while the period, particularly before the First World War, was probably the strongest period for anarcho-syndicalism, it declined somewhat up to the Second World War and virtually collapsed after that, particularly because of obviously of the problems the surviving Jews then had, and basically the triumph of Zionism as a political idea, which destroyed Jewish anarchism among those who were still alive. I think basically, even though after the Second World War were probably the biggest social advances in the UK, the reality is, of course, they came from the workers. They weren't granted by the great political party that the workers had created, the Labour Party. And I think we've seen in the 50, 60 years since that once workers' power and workers' influence on the party is lost, as it was in the 80s, you see what happens to a political party. And we'd see now what has happened to the great workers' party, the Labour Party, as the trade unions have been destroyed. And as it said, the basis of socialist activity, which is among the workers and is among the trade unions, is lost. The political party that's supposed to be fighting for their wishes is as bad as the party that was supposedly opposing them. And now I'll pass on so we can talk about
it. Yeah, basically what I'm going to address, and well, to some extent anyway, is how do or can the ideas of people like Rudolf Rocker and anarcho-syndicalist methods of workplace organising relate to workers today, particularly given that in many countries it's sort of anarcho-syndicalist current is a lot, as Donna has said, is a lot weaker than it was in the past. I'll start with a wee bit on unions. Trade unions, or combinations as they were originally called, were the first organisations that the working class threw up in struggle against capitalism. They were essentially defence organisations for workers under capitalism. Various forms of union organisation have existed and continue to exist across the globe. And I think we have to recognise that the very existence of trade unions is a challenge to the right of the bosses to set wages and conditions at work. Some unions developed further than that. Some unions developed a recognition of the inadequacies of craft unions and guild unions and political parties to adequately represent working class interests, and they became more than defence organisations. They became, well, a force for revolutionary change in society. Examples of these types of unions, particularly in the pre-sort of World War I period and in the interwar years, would have included revolutionary syndicalist and anarcho-syndicalist unions such as the FORA in Argentina, which had 200,000 members in 1922. The early CGT in France had over 2 million members in 1919. The USI in Italy had 500,000 members in 1919. There was also the FAUD in Germany, which had 120,000 members in 1922. There's the IWW, which had 30,000 in Canada and the USA in 1930. And probably most famously, the Spanish CNT, which had 2 million members in 1936. Not only did these unions wish to win the best conditions from their employers in the here and now, but they recognised that the only meaningful victory over their bosses would come about through the replacement of capitalism with a society based on need as opposed to one based on profit. In Ireland, there were undoubtedly syndicalist influences on the Irish Transport and General Workers Union. But these days that's only referred to in historical terms by its descendant, which is known as SIPTU, Services Industrial Professional Technical Union, a union that I had the dubious position of being a shop steward in for most of the 8.5 years that I worked in Northern Ireland Railways in a previous existence. So, you know, in recognising that sort of syndicalist legacy in SIPTU, it's basically put along the lines of, you know, conflict and high levels of class struggle were all right historically, but, you know, it's tied into the idea of social partnership that we've brought people so far that you don't really need those levels of agitation or struggle anymore. I think that that's an attitude that's, particularly in the current climate of, recession. I'd argue that the recession's here isn't about to hit, it's already started. That, you know, those levels of struggle are what is called for today, as opposed to social partnership. I'd also say that basically the day-to-day realities faced by working people who make up the membership of trade unions in Ireland and Britain don't square with the inadequacies of an organised labour movement that is still marred with sectionalism, outmoded craft attitudes and forms of organisation, or mergers and amalgamations that are really based on not solidarity, but concerns about providing services, like insurance schemes to the members of unions. I think the trade union movement has allowed itself to be further undermined by anti-working class labour legislation. There's a contradiction between the union leadership's commitment to social partnership with the bosses on a local and global scale that undermines the role of the position of the vast majority of trade union members. All too often, workers have to battle their union hierarchy before they can bring a struggle for better terms and conditions to the bosses. You know, it's time and time again, you know, through experience and through talking to other people, I know that people really have to struggle with the leaderships of their unions before they can actually start dealing with attacks on their terms and conditions. I mean, certainly, probably in the starkest example of this, I saw or was involved in a dispute in NIR a number of years ago, Northern Ireland Railways a number of years ago, that had, I think it was 96% rejection of a pay offer, and that was maintained, which is unusual, that the same level of support for industrial action was maintained after the rejection of the pay offer. That threat of industrial action was withdrawn by a full-time official without consultation with the members of the union. That's probably one of the worst examples that I've ever had the experience, or the better experience of being involved in. How do the ideas of the likes of Rudolf Rocker have a bearing on the way workers organise to resist attacks on their terms and conditions? I think, really, a few things have happened. You know, there have been attempts at setting up rank and file sort of initiatives within unions. Usually, though, they lack sort of coherence and focus beyond the initial disputes that are involved in. You know, they can increase in popularity if there's a particular dispute going on, but they seem to sort of, shrink back again when the dispute has been concluded, either successfully or unsuccessfully. Another strategy promoted by a lot of the party political left is a sort of broad front strategy. Now, that can be maintained, but I would say that the biggest problem with that is that the argument is that they seek to replace the people who are sitting in the leadership of the trade unions. And I think that misunderstands the nature of the problem. We've also seen a rise in unofficial or wildcat strikes in recent years. I think the post office is probably one of the major examples of that, although not the only example. So you have workers basically taking matters into their own hands, you know, not relying on the processes that are demanded of you when you go to ballot for industrial action. You know, you have a long drawn out process that basically strangles the effect, or diminishes the effectiveness of any action you can take by the time you actually get to really being on strike, or, you know, whatever other form your dispute might take. Seen a tendency in recent years as well to for people to move from one trade union to another trade union. That's not something that I have seen work very well for people. Given the nature of the recognition legislation that New Labour brought into effect, when you have people leave one union and go to another union that's also committed to social partnership, but it might make, exaggerated promises to get new members, you're left in a position where the original union, even if it's only got a minority of the workforce, will still be the official representative of that workforce in negotiations. So it's not something I would actively encourage. It is something I've witnessed happening, but I can talk a wee bit more about it. If anyone wants to ask me about examples of that, I'll talk in more detail about it afterwards. Ireland's also seen what splits from the likes of CIP2. I was at a conference in Ennis many, many years ago when the Irish Locomotive Drivers Association was set up as a breakaway from CIP2. I'm not sure if it's the role of anarchists or anarcho-syndicalists to actively encourage that at this stage, but where workers actually do see no other option, I think it has to be supported. And there are problems with the very nature of those splits. I mean, the ILDA, Irish Locomotive Drivers Association, although in terms of CIP2 it was probably quite progressive and some of the demands that they'd made of CIP2 that weren't granted were legitimate, it did seem to represent a regression back into craft unionism, you know, that prioritised the concerns of local drivers and was based on the strength of train drivers more so than any sort of general concern for workers in the industry as a whole. I do feel that the contradictions within the trade union movement can provide the basis of a new revolutionary union movement, but I don't think that anybody's in a position to harness those contradictions or, you know, push them in a progressive, you know, in a positive manner at this stage. I do think there is a seed of something in that, but really we need to talk about solidarity and overcoming sectionalism and what sort of approaches can best do that. When I worked on the railway, when there were issues that affected grades of staff, we would have meetings for everybody affected by a management proposal. No matter if they were a member of the recognised union or not, people could come along. That sort of equates to a more assemblyist type approach. It's grounded in the workplace. We wouldn't generally have involved full-time officials in that until people have actually decided what their response was going to be. Then basically let the full-time official know would have been the extent of that. We didn't take leadership from full-time officials. And I think that's an approach that can be put into effect in different workplaces. And it can include everybody in the workplace. I don't see any benefit in just pushing things through the official trade union structure, branch or bureaucracy. So how do we build solidarity? Really, it has to be about bringing networks of people together. Workplace based in the first instance, but building support for disputes, you know, across trade union barriers, getting activists involved in supporting each other in their struggles, and building on that and trying to maintain some sort of some sort of sense of organisation there, trying to maintain links between people who will be willing to assist in disputes, publicise disputes and build support for disputes outside of the areas that they're happening in. A lot of the time, the existing trade unions are, or their leaderships are happier to keep disputes isolated. So ultimately, I think the ideas of anarcho-syndicalism, the ideas that Rudolf Rocker expresses very well in anarcho-syndicalism theory and practice, do find expression in the creation of anarcho-syndicalist unions, of revolutionary industrial unions in the long term. But in the short term, well, basically in the immediate, the short, short to pretty immediate term, that doesn't appear to be on the agenda. So it's maximising solidarity, it's bringing people together, and it's building support for other workers in struggle. And I think that's the position that workplace activists are in today. And it's learning those sorts of lessons from the tradition of anarcho-syndicalism, drawing out the best of that current of revolutionary organisation. And basically, again, as Donna has said earlier, in relation to charges that anarchists aren't interested in immediately improving the conditions of working class people, the answer to that is yes, they are, but we need to do that as working class people with other working class people. You know, it's, that's where it has to come from, not from the outside, from a political party. I don't think we can rely on the trade union bureaucracy either. It's about starting to build networks amongst people and developing in that direction. So that's where I would see the ideas of the likes of Rudolf Rocker having a direct impact on where people are in the present. As I say, that basically covers what I wanted to say here. And I will pass on to Chekhov Fina.
Okay, I'm talking about anarchists in the media, and the real question for me anyway is, like, how should anarchists approach the media? It's a big and important thing. The first thing that we should say is, well, currently we don't get a very good coverage in the media. Okay, we either get completely ignored, and the few times when we manage to sort of create a big protest or some large movement, we get this, which is, this is from Wheel Gas Verdi, this is from the protest in May Day in 2004 in Dublin. We get the anarchist teacher, the anarchist organizer by night who teaches our children by day. We get some lots of really pretty poor coverage. I've got an article here, anarchists say they'll release enough gas to kill 10,000 Dubliners. And we've got bad anarchists from Dublin, Royston Brady. We've got May Day rioters, let Dublin burn. Garda's May Day dirty bomb fear. Anarchists ready for battle in the streets. Mindless mob aids to cause mayhem. Anarchist threat to Germany. Weekend of anarchy. And so on. So you basically get the picture. And that's actually pretty typical of the sort of mainstream media coverage we get. Now, I think most anyone who's been an anarchist for a while sort of realises that that's and comes to expect it. The first question that we ask is, why do we get such coverage that is, you know, to somebody reading the Sun, you know, who doesn't know anything about anarchists, it might seem that there's some basis to this sort of thing, but to anyone who's an anarchist, they immediately know that this stuff is just completely from the moon, you know. But and to understand it, we have to actually look at the structure of the media. Like, there's a knee-jerk reaction which is to say journalists are all lazy and liars and dirtbirds and stuff like that, and while there are some of them, that's actually the exception, I think, rather than the rule. It's we have to look at how the media is actually structured. And there's a whole bunch of things. I'm not going to go into this in great detail because people like Chomsky and stuff like that have developed very sophisticated models. Like the Chomsky has a model of various filters that act, and there's various other approaches. But there's various forces that basically push the media to report generally in certain directions. One is the obvious one is ownership. Media is owned by the state or by large corporations. Advertising is just pretty much all media's major source of revenue nowadays. It's also political pressures. If you say something that annoys somebody who's powerful, you're just going to get hassle for it. And it's easier to write something that doesn't annoy somebody powerful because you won't get hassle for it, and so on. There's also the increasing commercialism, the extreme commercial pressures in media like there is in everything, and so sensationalism and infotainment are the order of the day. You get increasingly short sound bites to express ideas, and this sort of means that you can only really express very simple stories. Like if you look at most media stories, you can break them down into about a dozen narratives. Okay, this is news coverage rather than sort of in-depth stuff, but a dozen narratives, and they're sort of very simple narratives. You know, they're sort of fairy stories, other than goodies, baddies, the goodies win in the end, or whatever. You know, but it's not that sophisticated, or it's not that there's not a very great range of sort of narratives that can come from these. One of the big things now, I think, that has been a real change since the 1980s, since the NUJ and the printers were pretty much defeated in the UK when Murdoch took people to Wapping. The industrial strength of the workers in the media has significantly decreased, and there's been as a result of that, there's been a huge amount of stuff like outsourcing, okay? And in outsourcing in the media, it's, okay, so, for example, independent newspapers have outsourced their sub-editing at the moment, okay? And this all gives people less control, less ability to influence and to fight it back against these forces. There's a recent book just published by Nick Davies, this book, Flat Earth News, that goes into this in great detail. Actually, it's really well researched, and the really good thing about it is he's from a position, he's a long-term Guardian journalist, and he looks, whereas Chomsky tends to look at quite an abstract picture of how the media works, Nick Davies is actually inside the newsrooms and sort of seeing exactly what's doing, and he's counting stuff as well, and what comes out of it is a picture where the production, a lot of the actual production of news and the sourcing of news has been outsourced not to, you know, freelancers, but to PR. So the people who produce actually and write the news go out and find it is the PR industry. An awful lot of journalism is collating that. People have increasing time pressures and stuff like that. And so we've got a whole range of systematic and systemic things that sort of push the media in certain ways. Now, and that essentially basically mean that the media is inherently, structurally going to be hostile to the ideas of anarchists, okay, which is anti-state ideas, anti-capitalist ideas. It's as an institution that's controlled by the state and by big corporations, they're going to be hostile to us. And there's very little we can do about that, okay? But now the question is, given this situation, what should we do about it, okay? So one thing that has been very popular with anarchists is to try and build alternative media institutions, okay? So the best known of these would be the indie media movement. It came out of in 1999 in Seattle. There was the protest there for the World Trade Organization, and basically a lot of the sort of global justice campaigners and so on who went there decided, listen, they're going to write lies about us, we have to try and report our own stuff, okay? So they set up this open publishing website. People, it was a huge success in the first couple of days, got a million hits, which was a big deal in 99, and it actually managed to, people weren't, it managed to produce sort of relatively unmediated communication, so people could report their own stories, their own pictures, their own stuff like that, and other people could get a view of what was happening that wasn't coming through this large corporate machine. This, however, I don't think, now people might disagree with me, I don't think these type of things are ever going to basically replace, or in any danger of replacing the mainstream media anytime soon. Okay, there's they have huge amounts of deficiencies. The big one is it takes a lot of time to go out and find news. Okay, so whereas somebody might, you get lots of on things like indie media, you'll get lots of coverage of street protests and riots and stuff like that. People will do that, but people aren't going to sit in a district court all day for fun to write about it. They aren't going to hang out in the local government chambers and stuff like that. Now, actually, increasingly, the mainstream media doesn't either, and they rely on the press releases from the mainly from the state, from the security services for that type of stuff. But as an idea, and the other one is just resources. Okay, so Indie Media Ireland, I'm one of the editors of Indie Media Ireland. Our budget is probably about $2,000 a year. Okay, so that is dwarfed by the smallest local newspaper. You know, they have a budget of generally a couple of million or something like that a year. Okay, so we have this problem. We can try, and the internet has made this much easier. We can build. We have a distribution network. But again, it's the resources, it's the money and the expertise and stuff like that, and having people that you can actually pay people to go and do things. And I think that's needed. So again, as I say, the things like indie media, alternative media institutions can be really powerful. They can give us some channel for news, but we're not going to be reaching that many people. So therefore, I think now some anarchists have, because of the dreadful coverage that we traditionally get, just to have an attitude of we won't talk to them, screw them, you know. And typically in the UK, that's the attitude. Like, for example, the Wombles were involved in this. They have a very hostile attitude to journalists. Like, if there was a Womble here, they'd be thrown half of stage for being journalists. Literally, I mean, and that's also extremely counterproductive, because the thing is, if there's absolutely no objection to them portraying us as mad people who gas 10,000 people, then people are going to believe it. Okay, you have to, I believe, try and do your best to at least disagree with us. Put yourself on the record saying that's completely rubbish. It's better than they wouldn't say anything to us and they just attacked us. It makes us look better. And we have to also appreciate that the mainstream media, its circulation, its reach, it reaches. Even, you know, papers in Ireland will probably be read, you know, the dailies, their sales of over 100,000, they'll probably be read by couple of hundred thousand, quarter of a million people each. That's fast compared to anything we can put out. Okay, so, like, Work in Solidarity, the paper we put out, we produce 10,000 copies of that every couple of months, okay? So there's more copies of, you know, at one single Sunday, the Sunday Independent produces more copies than we've ever produced, probably. Okay, so there's a vast differences in scale, and for that reason, because the mainstream media can reach so many, much more people, anything that we can do to affect it, any message that we can get out, any sort of hindrance we can put to people demonising us helps, because it's just reaching so many people. Now, if we go back to May Day 2004, when all this stuff came out, it was actually a pretty good case study of how you can fight back against, because basically what happened was the London Met had sent their PR guy over, okay, and he'd been used to doing the London May Day things, okay, which was, and these stories had all been run in places like the Standard before, the Evening Standard in the UK, so they just, oh, it's the anarchists, here's what we should put out, these dumbass stories, and they'll lap them up, and the anarchists will go and attack us and get those more dumbass stories. But we didn't do that, actually. We attempted to get in the media as much as possible. And they made a mistake. They went too over the top. The anarchist movement in Ireland isn't the same as in the UK. It's sort of more mainstream, links. Here, it's less ghettoized here to some extent. And so there was lots of people in the NUJ, for example, who were looking at this stuff and just feeling really ashamed. Like Seamus Doody came and talked to the indie media in a squat, which was a very peculiar move. And you know, it was, he certainly said, like, oh, this is, shames all journalists, you know, this type of stuff. But because of that, and because we took an attitude that, yeah, we'll go on, we'll go against these stuff, we actually got, we got in the last few days of the whole thing, we got some of the broadsheet quality media moving against the tabloids and shifting the story from being the crazy anarchists are going to kill us all, to the tabloids are going crazy about the crazy anarchists are going to kill us all, and they probably won't kill us all anyway. And we managed to get a Aileen O'Carroll on the Late Late Show, which is the probably for in the South anyway. It is the biggest show with the biggest reach and sort of the biggest cultural footprint. And so she got a chance. She was up against a journalist, Darren Boyle from The Star, and a security expert called Declan Power. He's a very peculiar guy who pops up always as a security expert, and nobody knows who he works for. But she had a very hostile time, but at least she got to say, yeah, I'm an anarchist. I'm not a total, and got like a few sound bites out and a few little bit of discussion. But because of us taking that tack, as I say, the sort of the people who saw themselves, the quality media, sort of moved against the tabloids, and that actually stopped the police from going in and cracking our skulls. You know, and that made a big difference. Not necessarily, okay, so we got the word anarchist out there a bit, and alternative ideas a little bit, but actually, because you had this shift where a lot of the media, even before it kicked off, said, you know, they're sort of losing the run of themselves, it, in my opinion, it really put manners in what they could do to us. They couldn't beat us off the street nearly so much. So, anyway, I think we have enormous problems in sort of using the media to get our point across, but I do think we need to have a parallel sort of approach where we are trying to build up alternative means of distributing and getting our news to people and getting our opinions to people, but at the same time trying to do at least damage limitation in what is written about us in the mainstream. So I'd be interested in other people's opinions, particularly like there's people here who work in journalism, as to whether they think that's a sensible strategy, or whether, you know, we're being too purist, or we're even being too open-minded towards the mainstream media.
Right. We're going to wrap up here about 9 o'clock, so we have, 45 minutes or so for discussion. Anyone has any questions, any comments, anything they'd like to say about Rudolf Rocker, or to address Chekhov's question of, or any journalist want to answer Chekhov's question, far away. Mark.
I have 3 points
to use
all.
First
of all, the
Anarchist
Institute is they have a successful journalist strike against the system right in 1912, and they won it. And we have down two reasons. One, 15 years previous to that, they put out this paper, it's the Workers' Way, and saying, or I keep direct action, Workers' Solidarity. And they did have direct action to the paper movement. Two, they encouraged to set up trade unions. And how we look at the NUJ website, and I noticed that there's an NUJ magazine called The Journalist. Now, does it advocate direct action and worker solidarity? And if not, why aren't there journalists like you doing the paper, their own kind of tribune-based paper that does advocate things like that?
Well, to be honest, actually, the NUJ is probably one of the more radical and one of the flatter unions in the UK. It's a fairly small union, so as a result it hasn't built up the level of hierarchy that some of the big ones. I'm also Sean Stewart for the, well, it's now Unite, from previously the TNG, previously ACT, which is the exact opposite. So, in fact, actually, there is some fairly... Now, we do have to remain, as a major published thing, as the Ledge Waller remembers, we do have to, unfortunately, remain within the law in the UK. But at the same time, the question of solidarity and the question of support for strike action... Now, in fact, the next issue is going to be an interesting one, because you may or may not be aware that Express newspapers are out on the picket line at the moment. Fundamental terms and issues of terms and conditions on pay, but also there's a very, very strong element of the issues of quality in this strike as well. Express, of course, had just a massive payout and a front page apology to the family of, what's her name, missing girl. Thank you. And there is very much a big move within the media, and to bring to bring up these issues. And so that's the interesting thing about the NUJ. Even though we are a union that covers newspapers, and often truly atrocious newspapers like the Express, in terms of what they put out. In fact, we have our current president is an Express newspaper journalist. And we have built up an element of radicalism in areas that you really wouldn't expect it. So I think the NUJ in that case, in terms of support for strike action, in terms of support for solidarity between colleagues, but also about trying to get the community involved. There was a major Stand Up for Journalism campaign that ran last year. We had a one-day day of action, which was very much about getting local communities involved in the issues facing journalism, building support, building solidarity between people on the ground. So actually, the thing I say about the NUJ is the NUJ is not quite an anarcho-syndicalist. I wouldn't go that far. Well, yes, there are PP members. But it is very much a union that's based on the grassroots level, in the workplace level, and really focused that way and fights on that level. And definitely a union that's not afraid to strike, as Miles knows well.
Sorry. Yeah. Can I just ask Peter or two points?
Was that not the first one?
The second one, the easiest, is on that kind of point about mixed organisation in the workplace. This thing about producing paper, a journalist paper, why isn't there, I was off the top of my head, several people in Belfast who are involved in education. Why isn't there an education workers network in Belfast, and why isn't there one in Ireland?
Good question. Maybe people involved in education that you know could get together and
yes, there's enough people
sort that out.
It, and we all, I know there'll be arguments about, you know, should what we call it a union, will be something else, and disagreements about type of types of work this organisation, but I think there's potential there for something.
I believe there was an attempt 2 years ago to set up an education workers network here, and there was a meeting called, it was about 2 years ago. But there was interest, but just didn't seem to take off. But that was something I considered.
I think there certainly are more people of what an anarchist that are involved in education now than even 2 years ago, in Belfast alone and across Ireland, no doubt. So I would think that's something worth pursuing.
Right, so the third thing is, my cousin happens to be a slum journalist, and involved in Dublin, and there is I thought about going to some of the NUJ, my perception is that journalists are kind of mainstream stuff, and I think what does Scott to do with this organisation, tell them to look at their website, stuff like that. But it's like, even in the sub, there's like a massive contradiction because there's like a handful of the journalists, the staff, are on permanent, full-time permanent contracts. Everybody else is on variable contracts where they get 5 shifts a week and they get paid £100 per shift. But that's actually worked out the bugger all because no sickness pay, no holiday pay, no voice, everything comes out of their money. So there is a kind of inroad into that world as people, as workers, because... there's just a massive contradiction that there are kind of journalists in the Sun and other mainstream media outlets are supporting this system, but at the same time they're getting completely fucked over by it.
Miles.
Yeah, hi, my name's Miles. I'm from the NUJ, I'm from Manchester branch. I don't know if you just mentioned my name in connection with strikes, because I was a full-time official, I'm not anymore. I was a full-time official, I happen to be a full-time official in the north of England. And there was a large wave of strikes, which started in 2002 and I think went on until about probably 2005. The strike of Express newspapers tomorrow includes a group of workers in Preston who are part of their company, who I helped to organise. I suppose in a way it's still going on, but it's not quite as fractious as it was. Not because I'm not there, just because of changing circumstances. But I think that your point about the NUJ solidarity is actually... the union does do it. It's a strange union, because obviously it is part of the bureaucracy, but it acts in a very bottom-up way. So although I was a full-time official, it wasn't the case that I think we were quite lucky, because we were dealing with small groups of workers. It may sound, you may think, well, that means you're not very strong, but actually it means everybody can be involved. So, for example, if we had a strike, say, in Bradford, there would be no question of people going on strike because they've been told to by somebody else. It would be a case of them all meeting in a room and making that decision. And there would be no question of someone else telling them to go back to work, because we'd have a meeting with the management. We'd walk straight out of the meeting with the management into the pub to tell them what the league latest was, and they'd say, yes, we'll accept that, or no, we won't. And it would be the decision would always be taken every day as to what to do next by the group of people. And I think the union, although they're actually part, Bradford is the example I'm giving you because they were the first ones to go on strike and they started it all, they're actually part of a massive multinational company owned from Washington, that in the US, not in Durham, that makes, what is it, $1 billion a year profit, is it? No, or more than $1 billion a year profit. It's a huge, huge organisation. And they, across there, they sort of fought guerrilla action, really, and one of them would get a bit of a rise, and then someone else would say, well, we want that too. And being able to control it through small groups of workers was actually quite important. And what we did was we did, you know, it was quite radical then, but now it doesn't seem to be. We did email newsletters immediately when things were happening, where we put out straight away to members and to non-journalists, other trade unionists, and they would then get sent on to other people, and people would get money, they'd get messages of support, they'd get all sorts of stuff, people coming to the picket line. And that sort of instant organisation using, frankly, text messaging and email, really, was how we built that wave of action. And I think that you talked about how to use the media. I think you've got to use those things, haven't you, those quick things. It's like you said about we need to be able to get around the trade union laws and do things quickly. I mean, we didn't have unofficial action very often. We had one or two things that were unofficial, but pretty much all of them were due to ballots. But then you have to, but you can still use the modern means of communication to create quick responses. Even once you've set up the ballot and it's all happening, you can then still move it on, certainly in terms of solidarity, by doing stuff quickly. So I think the NUJ has actually done that pretty well. It's interesting that you looked at the website and you picked up those issues. In terms of, I mean, I'm going to have to go because I'm supposed to get another NUJ event, so I apologise for that. It's a bit rude to speak and then go, but hey, you know. Tony Bender, every meeting gets to do that, so I should not. The thing about how to use the media, I would argue that I would agree with you, really, about doing both your own and using the email and the text messages and the other blogging. But standard for journalism that Donica mentioned, we actually had a deliberate strategy of getting bloggers to write about it, which was an interesting thing that we haven't done before. I don't know whether it helped. It was a successful day, so maybe it did. Certainly didn't do any harm. But I mean, I was doing some of the PR for that, and I was sending letters to bloggers saying, write about this, and you know, they were. So it created a different feel to it. In terms of the mainstream media, one thing I think people often forget, certainly they do in England, is they think, well, I want to be in The Independent, you know, which is a title that exists different paper but in both countries, so it's easier to use. They think I want to get in The Independent, but actually they forget about getting in, you know, the Blackpool Citizen. And actually the local free paper might seem to be neither here nor there, because it's a free leaflet drop into every house in this case, Blackpool. And I think that, you know, lots of them have what's on columns. You know, if you sent a paragraph about the fact that you're having a meeting at 7 o'clock speaking about the history of some trade unionist from London, they'd actually put that in their what's on column. They don't, you know, they're keen to have those things in. It might not be the impact that you want, but there's a way of getting the mainstream media to put your stuff around every house, just by thinking about how can we get it in the most, well, you know, send in papers I used to work and had a society news page. If the Anarchist Society had sent in their news, we'd have put it in with the Women's Institute, you know, well, it would have been there and we would have put it in. So I think you need to think about, actually, the mainstream media at a much lower level, if you like, because you're not going to get the Sun to do a front page lead about a discussion about trade unions from London in 1908. It's just not, you know, they're never going to do it, but you would get that.
That's right, the gas, 10,000.
In fact, that's it, always trying to gas.
We've got the Rocker Memorial.
And the last thing I'll say before I go, I apologise I'm going to go, the last thing I'll say is, and one thing about, you know, you said that no one's heard of Rocker, but actually, in a way, those methods that those people were using to organise have become mainstream, because the TUC in England, in the UK, I don't think it comes to Northern Africa, you have the ICCU, don't you? But in the TUC in England, Scotland and Wales, organises something called the Organising Academy, and they teach young people generally. The NUJ's had someone go through that academy to organise workplaces that are currently unorganised using the recognition laws that you were talking about. But actually the things that they're saying could come straight out of that book, and this is the official movement. Now they're not necessarily saying at the end of this we will all out striking a social revolution, but they're saying use those methods, that idea of being involved in every struggle, however small it is, all that sort of stuff that you were reading out about, the organising of the factories in the East End, has actually become the mainstream of the organising model in the TUC in England. And it's what you do with it once you've started, obviously, where we might differ with the people who are the leaders of the TUC. But in a way, those ideas have been incorporated into the system. You know, it's something that anarchists talk about a lot, as the things getting incorporated into the system. I think those ideas have been incorporated into the system. So in some ways, that's a good thing. And in the NUJ, we've used that in a positive way, as Dominic and I have outlined. And that, I suppose, the struggle in all the other unions is to be able to take that stuff that is mainstream and then use it in the way that we want to. Anyway, on that point, I'm going to be rude and go before, but you can all slap me off everything I've said, so I'm not here. But thank you for organising the meeting. I'm sorry I've got to go somewhere else, and I'll see some of you tomorrow. Cheers.
No worries.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
When
you're
also with the NJ on the Wales branch, and also very heavily involved in the UK meeting, I think probably the most critical reporter on the UK side. Actually, I'm sorry, I missed the first part of the meeting, but what the last speaker actually said about the media limitations is pretty much spot on. You can't take on the Rupert Murdochs on this one, but I think you're also being unduly pessimistic because things are changing. Newspapers aren't dying, the tabloids aren't dying the quickest. In fact, if anything's going to be left at the end of the day, it's going to be those broadsheets which do are more sort of inclined to check their facts and have more responsibility towards their readers rather than putting out all these crappy scare stories and that kind of thing. And the other thing is like the growth of things like YouTube. I mean, I don't know what the situation is now, but right now in Britain, more people at the age of 35 spend more time on YouTube than do actually reading newspapers. And that does kind of level the playing field a little bit. The other day, the NUJ called a demonstration, it was a publicity stunt outside Scotland Yard. We had loads of our members harassed recently under the terrorist attacks. Basically, the police using excuse to target journalists like me, ones they don't particularly like, ones they think they might not be particularly sympathetic to them and their actions. And so we got the General Secretary of our trade union to stand outside, to book a loan demo, and stand outside Scotland Yard with a placard saying, "We deserve this loan." And so the men were expecting one person, then we got 40 photographers who come up and start surrounding them. And it may quite work through picture now, but men are probably thinking, "Oh well, just one of them, this is going to be in their magazines, so what, you know, another magazine, big deal with that kind of thing." What we're going to do now is we've actually got loads of really good footage of journalists being harassed by police, journalists being assaulted by police, and we're going to put all those interviews we took that day, and I'm going to cut it in with that footage into a nice little film, and then we're going to put it on YouTube, and then we're going to get all the bloggers and all the other sites to link to that, so that YouTube will report something like a million hits on that film, and the police are guaranteeing you, I think, they're fucking mad. Now, they will probably try and take it down, right? If they take it down, wicked, thank you very much, officer, it immediately becomes an international news story. Police sent some journalists complaining about police harassment, thank you very much, you know, please report that, police officer. So that's one sort of point. The other point, just to talk about the NUJ. The best thing about the union is that unlike the unions in Britain, it's not affiliated to the Labour Party, which is absolutely great. It is, you know, very much the members' union, and also it does very much respond to the needs of its members. I mean, there's extreme examples like me. A few years ago, I was coming to a G8 demonstration in Evian, Switzerland, and I got part of my leg blown off by a police grenade. The response by the union from that was support again, was absolutely brilliant. Also, the union were the first union in the country to immediately realise the horror of these IT cards that the British government were trying to bring in, and actually saying, we can really have a go about this because the first people that are going to get this, about these cards that are dedicated to journalists, these are the first people that are going to suffer, along with ethnic minorities and other sort of targets for the British state. So, now, on the whole, you know, we're not great, you know, we're not radical, we're not, you know, we're not a particular political union, but we are very good at sticking up for our members. And if you are involved in any kind of journalism, then I would advise you to join, because it is a bloody insurance policy more than anything else. At some point, you find yourself on the receiving end of a libel suit because of a corporation, and you have got hope and help, and all that funding, you defend yourself. Just leave it at that.
Thanks. Yeah, I was just wondering before
I'll let Michael in. So is the death of the tabloid something we should welcome, or is it something that the NUJ is going to be fighting on the grounds of, you know, redundancies and combat?
Okay, now, obviously that's a very good question. Obviously, the union is probably sort of like conscious of looking after the salaries and everything else for its members, which is why they've got this express strike at the moment. I'm addressing it from the angle of actually getting information out there. Okay, and actually leveling the playing field, right? You know, sooner or later, people are going to be watching all their telly on the internet rather than on the TV station. So again, it's going to be, you know, a little bit more difficult for the likes of Fox News to dominate, and it's going to be a little bit easier for people to actually put their own news out there. We've already got the technology where we can very easily edit stuff. You know, we can very easily film stuff. There's so much stuff we can do now, which, you know, 10, 15 years ago is completely beyond our reach and out of question. So that's really made, you know, life easier, and that sort of, that situation is accelerating. As far as the tabloids dying is concerned, newspaper is printed form, which is still, you know, most people's access to the news, even more so than the news on the telly. Sadly, the Independent, which is our most elected newspaper, is the smallest circulation. Channel 4 News, which is the best news service, is like by far the smallest competitor to BBC and ITV. But the papers get a bit more level. As far as jobs and precarity concerned, yeah, it's a very bad thing. Lots of newspapers are going to lose loads of staff. The first casualties are actually going to be the Murdoch newspapers who don't recognise the news anymore. The last casualty is going to be the Guardians of the Squad. You've got very effective channels. The Express has got a very effective channel as well. It's a very evil newspaper, but actually, I think it was the year before last, the Star newspaper, again, has got really a really funny sort of runner, a spoof edition of the Daily Jihad. And here's on page 3, model in her, like the cabinet, which is just pure blatant racism. And basically, the Star, you know, I mean, obviously, you've got to have a sense of humour and not take life too seriously to work on the Daily Star, but even the staff turned around and just said, well, fuck off, we are not printing this. And on one hand, you're telling us and our readers every day of the year there's a huge threat from terrorism, and now you're going to be And they actually had an emergency chapel meeting, and they just went straight to the editor and said, we're not printing this, end of story. If you want tomorrow's edition to come out, you better change it now because the clock's ticking, you've got to press in half an hour, and the editor back down. And that was a really important victory. So, they're not unbelievable. Yes, the Rupert Murdoch is one incredibly powerful. And yes, they've got, you know, the money, the resources, the advertising, everything that last week was talking about. But, you know, they are not invincible by any stretch of the imagination. Yes, we'll be resisting job cuts, we'll be resisting, you know, the death of tabloids and everything else. But as far as actually, you know, the anarchists, the Reds, and all the progressive elements in this world, is, you know, it's an opportunity. So.
One of the ironies with the Murdoch papers is that it's in fact when they let people go that the NUJ gets some power back. Because of the nature of the laws, and we're talking about the single recognition deals, the Murdoch papers have this bizarre, warped version of single recognition. They set up what's called NISA, News International Staff Association, which is a fake union. And under the British law, you've got what's called sweetheart deals, which means if management agree to recognise a union, they don't need to go through any process, it's just immediate. So what Murdoch did, set up NISA, NISA came, the moment the laws changed, set up NISA, NISA came in, gave it automatic recognition. No other union has any possibility at all of getting recognition, of challenging it. There is nothing they can do. However, what they did allow in the law was that any worker could be represented individually by the union, a representative of their choice. So what it means, the only time the NUJ gets to go in there is generally when there's a redundancy negotiation. And in fact, reality has forced the union to, the paper, I think it was on the Times, to actually negotiate collectively with the NUJ, simply because they were going to have to go through a whole swathe of individual negotiations. And they finally sat down and said, oh, can we not talk about them all together? Basically meant collective negotiation. And bit by bit, we're nibbling away at the edges of Murdoch on that, with a very strong chapter in The Sun in the UK. Totally unrecognised, absolutely no power, except when it's talking about redundancies. But it's there, and it's waiting. And whether it'll take a change in the law, or whether it'll take, you know, just more and more nibbling at the edges, we're currently looking at organising people in Dow Jones, which has just been bought by Murdoch, but they haven't quite noticed that he's bought it. He knows he bought it in the States, but I haven't quite noticed he bought it in the UK. So we've suddenly got what we're hoping to be is a fast track. We're recruitment, organizing, and potentially, very small potential, but potentially recognition in a Murdoch title, which would be very interesting. So there's a lot of that going on. It's a very strange contradiction that we are responsible for some, not necessarily personally, but some of our members are working for newspapers that are responsible for some of the most vile crap. But in most cases, it's not the journalists themselves. In fact, who even write them. We know the editorial interference on newspapers like The Express, the journalists will write relatively balanced piece, which gets ripped to shreds by Dirty Desmond and put back together. And headlines that have no relationship to the story at all. So the headlines are inflammatory, and then you read the story, and the story in no way backs up what the headline is saying. Complete nonsense stories. As anyone knows, it's the 5 million Roma who were due to arrive in the UK in the first of the EU. So it's a very interesting union to be part of, because there's very much those two levels. There are the journalists, and a radical grassroots union that's very bottom up, and there's very interesting solidarity getting communities involved. And then, yes, unfortunately, a lot of virulent right-wing bullshit-filled output. But you never know. The decline in ownership and decline in newspapers, we are seeing signs of, because of the decline in local newspapers, for example, and the vicious cuts that have been put in place, there are independent newspapers starting up. There's actually gaps there for people to start up their own newspapers and start them up because it's so much cheaper to do it. And all of these gaps being filled in across the board. And they're local journalists who are interested in proper media and doing these properly because their local newspapers aren't able to do it. As cable expands, as digital TV expands, all of these do present opportunities to do it and to get there. And, once, whatever group it is, and for the past couple of years, I remember the first time when Andrew from the Worker Solidarity Movement on RTE, I was known as the mole in RTE when I was there, because it was, I can't even remember what the story was. It wasn't an Irish story, but I think it was something to do with the media rights in the UK. They were looking for something to talk about. So I just passed them on the phone number of somebody from the Worker Solidarity Movement. And not only did he get on, but they kept the number and filed the number. And once you get your number of one of these contact books, it's exactly what you want, because within another couple of weeks, something else had happened somewhere else. I think it was a Czech demo. And they got called up something else, so they just ring up the number. And, for example, in Ireland, if you get your name and your number in the Morning Ireland contacts book, that's it. You will be called up very regularly if they're looking for something to do. So there are ways of getting in, there are ways of getting organised. And if you can do it with humour and intelligence as well, and that's the great thing. So you were with Andrew at the two-way on the radio around the time of, was it EU enlargement? Well, there was a journalist trying to... I think it was something World's trying to support the story, and it was Andrew ripping the piss out of it and succeeding brilliantly. He managed to absolutely, because the story was rubbish, absolute nonsense, and you had the journalists who wrote it on there trying to defend it and losing actually. So it is doctrine, using humour, using intelligence, and actually just being absolutely sure and straightforward with saying wrong, but being open.
Was that the Dublin Riot one? With Jim Cusack and me, that was me.
Oh, that was you.
Yeah. So.
Here and then yourself. So.
Go ahead. Have you?
That's you.
Just a brief comment. I mean, I think when indie media was getting formed, there was a missing gap in what it was talking about. And it was a lot of this, Chekhov's bringing up this, like, oh, we can't trust the media, we just go. And there really needed to be. I mean, and it was a lot of it was going on in the United States, and this was in the late 90s. That was just after the Gannett newspaper strike, which crippled the labor movement when they finally broke that strike. And I think that missing link was like really thinking about the word independent or indie. There should have been a dependee committee to support, the committee, the indie media committee to support dependee media. People who depend on their salary from, various, bosses of the newspapers. And I would encourage one indie media people to kind of try and build those links or try to have that. But also, I wonder if the NEJ, a couple of journalists showing up like yourselves, that, you could go and talk to some people, organize an event with indie media people and say, and I think people would be really excited in there, because there would be a bunch of them, and you would create pretty quickly a little force of people who are like, oh, we really have to support journalists in the media who are working on these issues. And that would be kind of interesting to have your own kind of, oh, phone call where you can call a squad of people who will support you. I mean, sometimes that's not always really useful in a union demonstration, but a lot of times the solidarity, you know, from outside is a really helpful thing.
We've done some of that every time we've signed the new media representative in the NEC, and every time we organise a new media event, I do send it out to the editorial list for London Indie Media. So we do, we have been organising, you know, we have got members who work for...
In London, we've actually aggressively recruited Indie Media, and initially they thought, well, actually, it's good for us to be in the NEJ because of the pigs can't handle it, and we've got press cards, but in turn, they've actually learned how to improve their reporting, make it more sophisticated, and actually, you know, they've learned a bit more about how the media works. It's not actually the great dark conspiracy that a lot of anarchists make it out to be. You know, this whole thing that the biggest thing was talking about, the Mongols on the media fucking off. I could see their point of view. They were really pissed off because they had, I mean, you know, there was one meeting where they worked out they actually had more undercover journalists in the meeting than they had activists. They understand why they're a bit annoyed about that, but at the same time, a lot of Indian people getting involved with the NUJ actually realising how it works and how the media works has been helpful. But at the same time, it's been very helpful for the NUJ and for other journalists to actually realise that, you know, outlets like Indian Media, it's not just Indian Media, you've got like Democracy Now, you've got loads of different sort of internet-based and, you know, paper-based outlets throughout the world. These people are not just propagandists, they are people who care passionately about getting accurate news out there, and yes, they're putting their own slant on it, but they're not saying great lies that the Daily Mail are saying, and at the same time, you know, there are people that are interested in getting properly researched and doing stories out there. So actually, the relationship between the two has been very good. It could go a lot further, and I can't speak from outside of London. I think, you know, it's not been nearly as to the same extent in that, so Sheffield or Birmingham or other parts of Britain.
And I think that WSM in that would be in a great position to, you know, do some stuff like that because of their experience in the May Day of Europe. So that would bring a position where a lot of people, you know, certainly in media movements could.
As well as always has, like, a significant number of journalists, both within Indie Media. Like, I write for Village Magazine. We also have, like, with fairly good relationships with, you know, a good dozen journalists, you know, who come and speak at our events and so on. So we always have, I mean, that was one of the things of getting Chen's duty down to the May Day Centre. Because at that time, we were experiencing, like, with among the anarchists, just a visceral hatred of all journalists. And so to try and, that was an attempt by us to sort of say, well, listen, it's not this, as you say, it's not this big conspiracy, it's not this big dark rest of people, and it's a system that's problematic rather than just, you know, the classical reaction of people when they see this stuff is journalists just are hack scumbags, you know, and there's a very big sort of stereotypical sort of picture that people have in their heads of, you know, the Sun Journal going, yeah, let's get some tips in there or whatever, you know, and that's really what looking at it from, like, an anarchist Indie Media point of view, that's what you expect, you know. So, but we have, and we continue to do that, to try and make efforts to build those links, you know, and to get Indie Media journalists to appreciate, like, some of the problems and some of the systemic factors that affect journalistic output.
Sorry,
yeah,
this one's from the Indie Media as well. I work in Brussels. And I would really try to stress the idea of overcoming this idea of who makes up journalists in the mainstream media. Now, it's not the case that the mainstream media is filled with a bunch of radicals or even progressives that are looking to put forward a very, you know, progressive perspective on events. However, what is the case is that most journalists have in their mind a sort of 1950s liberal style or even 1970s style, Woodward and Bernstein, that's their aim. And in trying to do that moderate little liberal kind of attempt at journalism, they're beaten down and crushed by their editors, by corporate concentration of the media, by outsourcing, by a range of different pressures. And then to go to a demonstration, if they are so liberally or even progressive or even radically minded as some of us may well be. And to be told, oh, fuck off you, journalist scum, that's another person who's just putting the screws to you. And, you know, so it is one of the worst strategies, absolutely, in trying to get a radical perspective in the media. One quick point on the internet. Absolutely. Use it as I mean, there are possibilities of getting radical ideas out there. They're thrown up by the internet, which don't exist in many other media forms. However, let's remember that originally even the print media, once upon a time, was a very cheap media, and that's where you had radical rags, in, you know, particularly in North America, pumping out the original labor newspapers and so on. And gradually, the printing presses, the newspapers, were taken over by the major corporate interests. Same with radio, and the same process is happening with the internet. There's a corporatization of the internet going on, and be very aware that things like YouTube and Facebook and so on, use them, absolutely use them, but let's not be werewolves with colored glasses here. There's a corporatization of the internet going on at the moment, and that may end up in a similar process where you have your Murdoch version of the internet.
And we have to find out on Facebook?
No, he's not even on MySpace.
The CIA on Facebook. But just to respond to that, I mean, I totally agree with you. I mean, we have to be very wary. Like one of the big things is like YouTube, Facebook, all of that, they have the copyright. You upload your own stuff, they can do whatever the hell they want with it. They can control it thereafter. Which is why I think indie media and stuff like that is so important, because it's actually, it's got the copyright idea, and it's genuinely unmediated, you know. If you look at the moment, the whole Web 2.0, so-called Web 2.0 revolution, is one of the big ideas now is what they call user-generated content, okay? And again, the major media looks at things like indie media and say, well, this is a great model for us, for our journalists, you know? And there's a thing that's just been notable, I think it's ICNN.com, which is like basically an indie media, but you've got CNN journalists saying, yeah, that's good enough, that's not good enough. So, I mean, I think you're exactly right that we're still at a stage where there's a lot of space there, but corporate interests will try and shut that down. And basically the way they do that is, you know, more and fancier gizmos, higher cost of entry and stuff like that. And I mean, we have to, we can't purely rely on the tools like YouTube and stuff that they put in front of us. We have to constantly be trying to sort of say, well, let's use the vast numbers of people and try and leverage all those people, their creativity to get something that we control that's outside of, you know, the copyright of Murdoch.
You think use your own hosting, don't be a citizen journalist on anyone else's site. Perhaps that is the thing, though. Perhaps you do get the voice into that citizen journalist column. So people with the BBC who see the normal plain filtered media, you know, they don't have time to read all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And they just put it out there so they can put out whatever you want, at least until they moderate it or reach it. One of the interesting thing about Rocco when you read the London News is actually how so many of his ideas, coming from a very radical perspective, actually chime with the current debates we're having now about quality in the media. One of the big points he made was that there was no point in them putting out bad radical newspapers. That he took on board, he learned Yiddish so that he could edit the Yiddish language newspapers of the Jewish anarchists. And for years was editor, was writer, commissioned pieces, and was absolutely concerned with making sure that high quality, informative and well-informed output. So it's find itself in a very interesting argument at the moment, where there's a lot of talk about what so-called Web 2.0 being very democratizing, being very liberating. Anyone can do their, produce news, can produce whatever they like, anyone can do it. And I find myself, as an anarchist, arguing for a more restricted version of the media. Simply because the more stuff that's churned out by people who aren't basing it on facts, or not basing it on real information, or not checking their facts, actually, the less freedom, the less democracy you have. Journalists actually have a democratic duty. Too many fail. But the reality is that the purpose of the media should be to inform people
so that they know what's going on, so they can take action about it. But unfortunately, we lose that too often. The answer to that is not just to open it right up, so everyone can do it. Because we probably know, if you listen to phone-in radio stations or whatever, it's only people with extreme views, and generally extreme right-wing views, are the ones who actually take the opportunity to do it. And we see that increasingly with blogs.
When that's their readership, I mean, if you call in with a different view, they have those chicken buttons, and if they lose, they turn you off.
Yes.
It's not a very good win.
And it's happening with the blogosphere. The promotion of extreme right-wing websites by right-wing media companies is increasing and increasing and increasing. And then you get your hit rates up, the more people are linked to you. So a right-wing newspaper can link to lots of very, very right-wing things. Sites like, have you ever seen Little Green Footballs? Mm-hmm. It's one of the most atrociously right-wing blog sites. Hugely popular. Mm-hmm. Massive hit rate. Massive. Yeah, but a really, really high search engine rating, simply because so many people link to it, and that's how the right wing media, and you know, whether it's government, whether it's whoever, can boost these views as well by constantly promoting the right wing side of it. So what we really need is quality media, but quality media with proper editorial independence and freedom to do things properly.
I think we have about 5 minutes left, so if anyone would like to.
One last quick thing on that, and going back to what you were saying, Walker, did with learning Yiddish and so on, and what you were talking about in terms of democracy now, and Irish in the media in particular, professionalism is not a right-wing conspiracy. We can do this as well. Democracy Now is fantastic. Slick, and increasingly popular radio and now web TV production, and it's radical. You know, we don't have to. It doesn't have to look like. It's just
been
done in a photocopier. We can do it as well.
We can make it more upbeat. This is very young. Yeah, I think that that's what anyone was there. Can we make some of that or take away?
Just basically, you know.
There's a panel that I believe that something is in the media is unprofessional in terms of not so much the structure but its comments. Anyone who came across it can is enough and informed opinion that there's a lot of rubbish written on it as well, at the same time. And I do understand why journalists will believe demonstrations, not because of journalists as such, but the fact is, in terms of photographs, for example, it's not because of journalists, because the police and security services usually force them through the courts to produce footage of demonstrations. It's not to say I agree with it, but I can understand the reasons behind it. Because any kind of confrontational situation arises from demonstrations, there's some cases.
Then you're losing your chance of getting any information.
That's why usually people in demonstrations have their own footage and breaking room reports of it.
Yeah, I think down the back. I don't
understand where it comes from.
Do you want to comment on that?
Just on the, you would think to look at the site, but actually, different media gets more posts than anyone else, most of us would get. Actually, for as long as we can lobby and neither of the truth is, but we do have to be dedicated. Moderators who write all this crap off, the news will have, and they're literally doing it on a minute-by-minute basis. So you actually write, and the open publishing is very, very open to abuse. And also the quality of what's stuff in there is really, really poor. Some of it's very good, some of it is really crappy. Interestingly, when I was covering the war in Lebanon for the media, they were getting more hits from the Middle East than they were from Britain, because those of the Middle East, respective Middle East brothers who are absolutely sick of like out of media, which is really conservative, linking directly to the kind of media, which is quite interesting. Particularly interesting when you end up getting those of comments and posts in Arabic, which obviously no one could understand. But I mean, with regard to the
Iowa, they were all about penis enlargement.
They were about penis enlargement, all about the Nigerians wanting millions of quid
in Yes,
that happened in the office. Yeah, quite a lot. Just like that, the German people asked me some of the questions, it was very understandable because demonstrators know, unless they're living on the planet, they know they're never going to get their hearing in the media. So, for potentially everyone's pointing a camera, and it's possibly going to get them arrested in prison, or just playing with an elected right, so their anger is very understandable. But the idea about all we'll have our own people is slightly naive. So the main reason for that is that if a policeman nicks a demonstrator with a camcorder or a camera,
they can immediately see that as evidence. If they admit the journalist who account for the law account, but it's known as special procedure material, so they really want to get to see it, they've got to say, get a judge to say so. And most judges, okay, not exactly on our side, but most judges will have to have a really damn good reason for journalistic material to be turned over to the cops. It's usually got to be that someone's been died or a very serious crime has been committed. It's very rare for the judges to actually give journalistic material to the police. So actually, you're actually less threatened by journalists than you are by your own people that have done that kind of press conference.
So with a couple of minutes left here, I think Tag Off would like to...
Just to go back to your point, John, like, I mean, on the quality of indie media, like... If you saw the quality before we hit all the stuff we hit, it's pretty bloody good quality up there now. But we have also, over the years, we have sort of had a constant pressure on to contributors to make them better quality. We'll hide stuff if it's unintelligible, for example. You know, and we really try and make people just do the basic journalistic stuff, the who, what, why, when, how, all that stuff, and to try and get it across to people. And so you can, there's no rule in the media that says, or of open publishing, that says you have to publish any old thing regardless of the fact that it's unintelligible. You know, and so we have always tempted, and in media Ireland is one that's always gone for sort of quality, as against some of the others which are more sort of any old thing. And so we have managed to, over the years, improve, again, because it's just incredibly open to abuse, anybody on the internet. And most of the people, a lot of the crap is posted by our enemies as well. It's right-wing Zionists.
Sunday Independent Journalists.
It's people trying to undermine it. Like, we have, Indymedia Ireland has a whole team of people who were running a blog, Indymedia Ireland Watch. Again, we have fairly good evidence that they were inside independent newspapers. And that basically what they were doing for some days is they posted a ridiculous story, and then we removed it, and they'd have a screen grab in between times, and they'd write like three or four stories a day of announcements. It was just incredible. If most people aren't journalists, most people aren't used to writing from the point of view of somebody who doesn't know anything about it. You know, you've got it, and people don't do that, so if you're opening something to the public, that's a problem you're going to face. You can help it and make it better and try and filter out the stuff that's completely unintelligible or try and reformat it and tidy stuff up a bit, but it's just that's just a problem if you don't have people who are trained, I think. It's a good one to ask. You can't pretend that, you know, it's all that amazingly the top notch stuff of best written and, you know, putting points, because it's not always.
Well, I think that's pretty much beaten by the time.
One environmental point at the end, and it comes to quality as well. I remember a few years ago, it was a Free Palestine or Anti-War, I think it was around 2001, and the Workers' Solidarity Movement had just started producing the new version of Workers' Solidarity. At the end of the march, I've been giving out a few hundred, I was giving them out as well. We looked back in the street, it was covered with discarded placards, discarded leaflets, discarded everything else, not one copy of Workers' Solidarity was left behind. So it's very satisfying. But so, quality also has an environmental benefit.
I think on that note, we'll thank everybody for coming along this evening. And, yeah.